This is Audible.
The Lords of Silence by Chris Raitt. Read by John Banks.
I imagined that I had encountered all possible cruelties. For a long time I had understood the worst pain was to be denied that for which we thirsted. The centuries passed, each colder than the last, and that knowledge was the sharpest thorn my father had left in our flesh. But I have been wrong so often before, and so I was again then. In those days, once the despoiler had broken the wheel of fate, and our jail's walls crumbled around us, we learned just how far we still had to go. The greatest cruelty, you see, was not being deprived of what we wanted. The greatest cruelty, as it turned out, was being given it.
Attributed to the Primarch Mortarion. 1. Solace. Chapter 1.
1. 2. 3.
He moves slowly. His claw reaches out, pushing through debris. Lights flicker, sulfur yellow, intermittent, like a failing heartbeat.
4. 5.
He does not want to count. His lips move unbidden, rehearsing well-trodden paths, stabilizing his nervous system. Numbers have power. The subtle know this, but still he does not want to do it.
6.
He pushes himself free of the piles of metal, the heaps of flesh and iron. His boots, cloven like devil hooves, find perches and push back. He drags himself out of the ruins, his breath wheezing through a rusted vox grill.
7.
That is the perfect number, the one that signifies the accomplishment and the end, but also the conception, and then the process. It gives him strength, though he does not wish it to. It has always given him strength, even before the long change, and he dimly remembers this. Now, it is just a habit. So many things are just habits now. He gets back to his feet. Detritus sheds from his back, clattering on the deck. Warning klaxons are sounding from somewhere, muffled and broken. A length of cable as thick as a torso hangs from the roof, glittering with a weak mantle of sparks. The grav field is off-kilter. He feels lighter than he should. His old plate should be heavy. It is crusted with the patina of age, thickened and fleshed, scabbed with boils and laced with glistening strings of pulled marrow. He staggers over to a servitor station and sees the wretched operator fused to the deck, its fingers locked into a cat's cradle of sensor plugs. It's dead now, the last strobes of its cortex blown out, which is probably for the best. He presses fat fingers to the command console, summoning status runes across greasy picta crystals. He sees that the ship lives. He sees that Solace's enemy is no longer in view. He wonders how much he aided the starship, or if this is just one more sign that things are running away from him.
"Dragon!"
he voxes, and gets nothing but static back over the link. Others are beginning to stir now. He sees one of his kindred emerge from under a sagging beam, helm lenses glowing vivid green in the dark. He sees a servitor twitch back into life, its bulbous stomach spilling across a disc-shaped tactical column. He sees a little lord plop down from a fizzing cluster of cabling. It shrieks as it splats on the deck, and he gathers it up carefully. It coos at him, and then nuzzles into the crutch of his elbow, snickering needle teeth. He is beginning to remember now. He is beginning to piece things together again. Is he slower now than he once was? The little lord starts to lick the blood from his cracked ceramite. Of course he's slower. Everything is slowing down, congested, like running through water. That's the gift, of course. That's one of the great objectives. Vaux turns on his heel, patting the little lord absently.
Lumens, if you please, he grunts. Get us moving.
The bridge responds. Crew stagger out of the dark, pull themselves up from behind half-melted cogitator stations, wipe sweat and mucus from their eyes. Around them, solace starts to come to life. It's hard to kill a ship like this. It's hard to kill any of them.
One,
he mutters, starting again. Dragan gets to his knees, snarling. The gun crew slave staggers over to him, perhaps trying to help him. This is a conceit, and he shoves the emaciated human into the wall, hears the faint snap of something osseous breaking. Then he's turning, drawing himself up to his full height. The gun cavern yawns away from him, its roof lost in dark clouds, draped with rotting cables like spider threads. Something big has detonated, hard enough to fry Solace's grav generators and throw the virtual axis off kilter. The ship's a big, bulky beast, so the damage must have been catastrophic and close. He slaps the side of his helm, then again, hard enough to knock some sense back into his incoming visual feed. His mood is dark, and he wonders if the explosion was somehow his failure. If so, that'll be more fodder for Vaux. The gun gangs are coming back to life. Several dozen lie in the murk of the deck, limbs severed or rib cages smashed. A chain-mounted lumen swings lazily over them like a sensor. The nearest gun barrel, a 200-meter-long iron howitzer, rears up through the miasma towards its gunnel sheath. Recoil columns splay out, lodge deep into the substructure. Much of the breach is still made of black metal, a meter thick at its thinnest point, crushingly heavy. Only the edges show creeping evidence of the biological. Strands of hair-thin follicles worming away, glacially slowly. They'll get there in the end, consuming the inorganic and replacing it with the tougher stuff of sinew and cord. 6 meters away, Gunnery Captain Kodad regains his feet. He's one of the more senior of the unchanged, and something like a uniform still clings to his hefty frame. His skin is white-grey and boils cluster at his neckline, but he might even pass for human normal in some of the grimier Imperial hives. Dragan looks into his smeary adjuster lens, then down the long rows of howitzers.
"What's the damage?" he growls.
"Significant,"
Kodad whispers. He always whispers now. Some wasting gift in his vocal cords, most likely.
It will take time.
Dragan grunts. He can smell promethium mingled with heavier aromas. Solace is bleeding somewhere.
Did you get a salvo off?
He asks. Kodad looks at him. His black-in-black eyes are unblinking.
6, Lord.
6?
Rather proud of the crews, Lord.
Dragan grunts again.
Not good enough, though, was it?
He snarls, and stalks out towards the exit aperture. His boots suck at the soft, fleshy stuff on the deck, the permanent soup of swill that bubbles and ferments in every crevice.
I'll be back in an hour. Any guns still out of action, I'll flay the loader teams. Get it done!
Vaux heads down from the bridge. As he goes, more lumens flicker back on. A grinding hum breaks out erratically from under the blackened deck plates. Servitors, the name they still give to the panoply of brainstem-clipped monsters who man the lower-level functions of the battleship, scuttle and lurch back into life. Some are almost human-shaped, with 2 legs and 2 arms, and the head they were born with. Most are not. Some are like insects, while others have been almost entirely swallowed into the embrace of the corridor walls, their dried skin fusing with nutrient lines and power cables, until all that remains is a half-glimpsed face. Those faces gape stupidly as Vaux passes, some vestigial recognition response making their jaws twitch. There was a time, Vaux thinks idly, that life and death were clearly delineated things. The human body would persist for a while, discreet from its fellows, before expiring and returning to the mulch. Now, though, every possible shade between the states of living and dying has been exploited. Half of his crew are, to all intents and purposes, semi-dead, or maybe semi-alive, their required service sustained by amalgams of ancient biotech and even older necromancy. He glances at one of the buried servitor faces. It has no eyes, no nose, just an open mouth crammed full of electric strobe lines. Its lower lip spasms. Vaux wonders if it can detect his presence. He reaches out and gently presses a withered cheek. Then he's moving again. There's no use pondering these things too deeply. It's all part of the great panoply, the more than infinite variety that he serves and seeks to propagate. In another reality, he might have had the leisure to study these creatures, to see just how far the boundaries of decay and resilience can be taken before the parameters snap. But that is not, of course, his calling. He works his way down a long spiral stair, wheezing as he goes. His lungs are half full of fluid, and he cannot help but think it a poor gift. Then again, he has thought other gifts were poor in the past, only to discover their genius much later.
"Forgive," he says, speaking softly to the little lord at his elbow.
The tiny demon giggles, then farts liquidly into the crook of his armour. That counts as forgiveness, probably. He reaches his destination. He is a long way down now, buried within the folded heart of Solace's central chamber core. It smells rich here, like old soil. He sees pale worms wriggling through the mouldering metalwork, each barely longer than his fingernail. They glow. They have many eyes and long teeth. Why does a worm need teeth? He's doing it again. Too curious. That's always been his problem. A door stands before him. It is made of wood. The beams are rotten and pocked with a sieve of beetle holes, and it all smells deeply of another world. Corroding iron bars and hinges creak as the door opens, letting a curtain of deep green miasma roll across the threshold. He steps inside and enters a dank chamber of mists and mellow putrescence. Tables, all of them hewn from thick beams of the same rotten wood, groan under the weight of age-spotted books. Candles flicker in their holders, struggling to stay alight against the humidity. Many pairs of tiny eyes blink from the shadows, red and vicious. Clocks tick, archaic mechanisms grind, and a hooked wheel turns slowly against the domed ceiling.
"Were you damaged?" Vaux asks.
A figure swivels in the murk, its face partly hidden by a thick cowl. Under those shadows pulses the evidence of many gifts. Boils, buboes, raised veins that throb with black fluid.
"No, not much,"
the tallyman Philemon replies, greeting Vaux with a nod.
"Too far down here. But you took a beating up there, yes?"
Vaux smiles wryly.
"We are still alive. Or what passes for it?"
He looks around. He breathes in the rich air and sees the many little lords squatting on high shelves. They grin back at him, chittering and belching.
"This one took a fall. Perhaps you will look."
He hands his charge to the tallyman, who lifts the doughy bag of flesh up to the flickering light and turns it over in his gauntlets.
"So I see,"
Philemon murmurs to the little lord.
"Perhaps stay here a while. You can assist me."
He reaches into a bag and pulls out something meaty with an eyelash still attached, before feeding it to the diminutive monster. It gurgles delightedly and hops up to the shelf with the rest of them, where a chattering tussle breaks out.
"Solace must be wounded,"
Philemon observes, reaching for a taper to light more candles.
"I feel it, even in these bowels."
"It will recover," Vaux says.
"What happened?"
"I do not know."
Vorks leans against a heavy pile of books, grimoire and ledgers, some open to reveal webs of inked diagrams and tables.
I thought we had a contest. They landed a few raiding parties, but we matched them in the void.
He shook his head.
The truth will emerge.
Philemon reaches up to scratch his chin. Something pops, and his fingers glisten.
Where does it leave us?
A long way from where we need to be.
Philemon pauses, and the abacus at his belt clinks.
Dangerous.
No more so than normal, says Vorks. Run the numbers, will you?
If you want. I need to trust a little more.
Philemon gives him a severe look.
You do, Siege Master. You trust.
All I have left, I think, sometimes.
It's all beginning. I told you that. When the scales tip, you could be happier about it.
Vorks chews at his lip. He can taste blood in his mouth, a thick soup made tangy by acid and gut rot.
Which way do they tip, though, eh?
He ruminates, running a finger down the spine of the nearest book.
We could be sliding down the wrong path. We have done it before.
Philemon snorts and shoots him an exasperated, though oddly affectionate, glance.
There are creatures, aquatic hunters, that are required to move at all times, or they die. That is our model. We stay in the void. We will die. Or Solus will kill you. Or Dragon will. Or Garstag. If you pause here, if you think, if you hesitate, they will be feeding your guts to their familiars.
Vorks does not smile.
You've been saying the same thing to me for 100 years.
This year, then, I hope you will listen.
Vorks shrugs. His upper lip twitches, catching on the corroded flecks of his inner helm. He cannot take the helm off any more. Very few of his warband can, at least those who have been unbroken for some time. They are no longer body and ceramite, but an increasingly intimate meld of the two. That is one of the many 100 reasons they are so hard to kill. Their fusion with their protection is so much more complete than that enjoyed by their imperial cousins.
Run the numbers, he says.
They can only tell you so much, says Philemon.
Better than nothing at all.
Vorks looks up at the little lord, now snoring contentedly, with flecks of skin and keratin on its rolling stomach. He can smell the decay, the falling away of the parchment, the slow collapse of the deck beneath and the roof above. A number is eternal. It is a form, not a body. It is the last thing left when the mind is rotted into a soup of tendrils, only fit for the gluttons of the deep bilge. You can hold on to a number. He wonders sometimes if even the Death Lord does just that, as if a number were a reminder of another possible life in another possible galaxy. He remembers what his master told him on the plague planet, and wonders if he somehow saw this coming. There are those who underestimate Mortarian subtlety.
I need to know,
he says, turning away from the books and the mould.
Do this for me, please.
Of course, says the Tallyman, watching him go. Whatever you want.
Chapter 2. The ship is moving. The cultivator of the Enginarium, Ro Tway, has succeeded in firing the third furnace, and there is fire and ichor chundering down the tubes again. More of the lanterns come on, flickering first, then throwing out that familiar dirty yellow glow from behind glass panels. The population is stirring. Many of them were killed, either by hard round void barrage or by the corpse spawn who got on board after the shields were knocked out. But there are thousands living in the dark deeps, and it is hard to get all of them. They have white skin that sags from their calcified cartilage, black in black eyes,
and fingers made long and tough from the things they have to prize open. Some of them might still be technically human, though most have moved on to alternative taxonomic classes. The variety is interesting. They dwell in the parts of the solace that few of the unbroken have reason to travel into, save, perhaps, for sport or to hunt. The ship is huge, and so there are many of these places. When the ship's hull was laid down in the 34th millennium on the forge world Lashtay, it was named Undying Valor. It entered service with Battlefleet Archon less than a year after structure completion, commanded by an inexperienced captain named Lutricia Prask. Its complement of more than 30,000 ratings was largely drawn from naval levy stations strung out beyond the Morn Ring, and was graded as competent by 4 subsequent inspection visits. Like all Coronis-class cruisers, it was heavily armed, with lance and macro-cannon arrays out of proportion to its relatively underweight shielding. It transpired that the class gradually fell out of favour with Imperial commanders, though the Undying Valor served with distinction for another 500 years, gaining a kill ratio marginally higher than its reputation indicated likely. Prask died in an engagement less than 20 years after assuming command, and was replaced by a succession of captains promoted from the lower decks. A cruiser-class ship was a world of its own, and only the very greatest battleships regularly recruited senior officers from outside the hull. Most captains were born, raised, and trained on the ship they would later command. The last of the line, Orthon Hemo, was of this tradition, and was said to have loved the ship more than his own children, of which there were 20 before circumstances intervened to curtail his commendable contribution to the replenishment of Imperial numbers. Those circumstances came at the Battle of the Borghese Channel, a vicious encounter in which the Imperium lost 20 vessels and had its grip loosened on 3 subsectors. By the time retribution fleets overwhelmed the region more than 60 standard years later, there was no sign of the Undying Valor and its last reported coordinates, only a slowly spinning core of metal, to which Hemo's deep-frozen corpse was, it was rumoured later, nailed on tight. And that was that. The Coronis class continued their long decline in Imperial service. When variants reappeared in the sporadic warfare of later centuries, they had been changed by the heavy corrosion of the eye, sporting modifications and eruptions that baffled, excited, and appalled the tech priests who studied them. One unnamed scholar, toiling away in some obscure Forge World's Collation Citadel, amended his report on these studies, changing the term Coronis to repulsive, possibly as some recondite form of Martian humour. The Mechanicus, not being a humorous order, took up the emendation as purely literal, and like some spreading organic virus, it became the preferred classification for what remained a rare class of warship within Imperial zones of control. Vorx did not seize the Undying Valor. By the time he became its master, it was already solace, and was already growing, changing, spiralling slowly down those deep wells of the eye, and soaking up their bottomless malice. For more than 5,000 years it steeped in that soul liquor, its spars flexing, its innards burning, its hull plates blistering. Its old core began to reform, untouched by demon rites or renegade tech marines, but impelled by its own semi-dormant creative impulse. Like so much else in that realm of dreams, physical form began to suffuse with a matter of souls. Now it breathes. It has respiration. It has circulation. It has whims, and it has moods. If it turns against you, you find corridors suddenly choked with bulging plates and boiling pits of runoff oil. Crew go missing from time to time, even from the ranks of the Unbroken. Sometimes they are discovered much later, bits of armour, stains on the deck, a faint smell of satisfied ingestion. Solace must be placated, it must be nourished, and it must be tended. If that is done, then it will fight for you, and it is very good at that. It is bulkier than it once was, heavier and thicker, and caked with steadily accumulated demorganic detritus, so much so that the old weakness in defence is no longer really there. It is a monster, It is a killing beast, a void wallower, a devourer of the corpse spawn's empty iron machines. But it is not invincible. It has been hurt now. Its skeleton has been partly exposed, and huge strips of flesh burned into ash. It is off-center, listing with its grav-pull askew as the stars wheel slowly around it. It gasps, sending plumes of red-tinged smoke seeping into the void. Its main plasma thrusters are black and cold, though Rotway has kindled the third furnace now. The levels after the plasma generators are still dark. Clado hurries through them, accompanied by four of his unbroken bodyguards. His armor is badly damaged, the needle arrays twisted and leaking, and there are sparks of strange electricity snaking over the plate. He is carrying two functional weapons, one in each hand. The first is a bolt pistol, its muzzle fashioned into the gaping jaws of some venomous species of blind slug. The second is attached to his forearm, an old Narthesium with its scissor-saw mandibles intact and the vacuum chamber working at near-optimal performance. That is a rare thing, and its owner is keen to use it.
"Up ahead,"
growls one of the bodyguard, an unbroken captain named Golk. Golk limps. One of his legs is wasted away within its armor shell, yet still supports his considerable bulk. The bones are shot to powder, the muscles are a stringy mess, and yet he still walks. Such mysteries. Clado does not respond. He already senses what he has come for. He can smell it somehow, amid the rich tapestry of stinks in the underbelly of the starship. A surgeon of the Death Guard learns to navigate by smells, the acrid puff of terror, the sweet and drawn-out fog of despair, the perennially exciting moment when a barren body is first infected, and the infinite joys are unleashed within its bloodstreams and limbic systems. The population are scattering before him, splashing off into the darkness. They are like rats, squeezing into every hole that will take them. The rusted iron of Solus's skeleton is intricate here, but still hot after the bombardment. There are places open to the void, and they must go carefully. They pass the carcass of a boarding torpedo some way back, burning in defiance of the void's vacuum. Its livery was a deep sable, displaying the chapter symbol of the iron shades of the Shoba Death World. Clado knows all the liveries. They've been studying their enemy for a long time, and there are only 1,000-odd chapters to master. The iron shades are a good enemy, tenacious and unrelenting. They have a philosophical disinterest that marks them out from their many peers. Their commitment to martial excellence is aesthetical as much as it is anything. They fight because they believe perfection is achieved through contest. Clado knows that this is nonsense. Fighting is mostly pointless, but if it has an end, that end is for some greater political purpose, such as putting the wheezing old super-psychic husk on Terra out of its misery and calling a stop to the whole sorry charade. In itself, considered in the abstract, fighting is little more than belching, a necessary part of life, but hardly the most distinguished. The smell becomes more intense. He hurries, his boots kicking up slurry. He can see bolt impact craters in the walls, already thickening with milky liquid. Bodies are everywhere, slumped and folded and floating in the scum-topped pools. God of decay, but they killed a lot of menials. He enters a hemispherical chamber. A bolt gun cracks out, flashing vividly and making the walls and roof burn white. He is hit twice, once in the chest, once in the leg. The aim is good, and he feels the pain of the impacts. His bodyguards return fire instantly, carpeting the far wall with a range of esoteric, more powerful weaponry. He hears grunts from the other side of the inferno and holds his Narthesium hand up to halt the destruction. Steam hisses, bilge water slaps and boils. Clado can feel his wounds close over. He can feel the bolt shells dissolving inside him, burned away by the acids within, and the pus oozing from his glands, coating the wounds and dribbling down the inside of his thick, soft armor plate. Once, his protective ceramite would have aimed to keep projectiles away from him. Now it absorbs them, sucking them in close, chewing and corroding the layers of diamantine and depleted uranium and cordite and, best of all, the sickly sweet propulsive fluids. He barely breaks stride. He sees the Iron Shade Space Marine clatter to the floor, his armor riddled with catastrophic damage. Clado takes in the tactical markers instantly. This one is from the 5th Battle Company, Void War Specialists. He comes closer and sees the sigils of distinguished service. His armor was already carrying damage, and now it's just a mess of shards and bloody flecks. He can see a face, gaunt, grey, studded with carapace plugs and honor tattoos. One eye stares at him. The Space Marine's fingers try to move. Clado kneels down. The smell is overwhelming now.
"Pretty good," he whispers,
as the Narthesian begins to whine up to speed.
"You got a long way in."
The Iron Shade tries to rise, to fight, to reach for a blade. It's pointless. His sinews are severed, his heart's hemorrhaging.
"But I'm feeling a bit unreasonable at the moment."
Clado selects a needle from the cycler and slots it into the Narthesium's array. He presses it against the flesh of the Space Marine's neck.
"A bit put out."
The Iron Shade almost manages to move, to get to that dagger at his belt that is just so tantalizingly close. Clado depresses the plunger.
"I'd normally be taking your progenoids," he says. "Don't worry, I'll be doing that soon enough."
The Space Marine's bloodshot eyes widen. He's tough, and he's trained, but there are pains beyond belief, and Clado knows them all.
"See, I was already irritated,"
the surgeon says,
"and then you shot me."
The sores spin and then hover closer. An old, sick light kindles in Clado's eyes.
"So this is going to be horrible," he says,
and begins. Dragan is furious. This is not the low-level habitual fury that animates his every breath and drives his every killing blow, but a precise fury directed at ignorance. They were fighting and being stretched, and then something happened. He was ripped away, thrown out into darkness as the ship reeled, and now they are... He does not know where they are. Dragan hates not knowing. His deadliness is built on certainty. He is not as old as some of his brothers. He was not spawned on Barbarous, but on an imperial world, and that fact worms away at him. You have to prove yourself in this environment, and any little thing can be made into a weapon against you. You have to work to turn those disadvantages into weapons you can use. And, see, so much of all the old prestige is no better than new shit. It doesn't matter. Vorx was spawned 10,000 years ago on a world now rendered inert by virus bombs, and Dragan was spawned 2,000 years ago on some imperial hive cluster that is, as far as he knows, still very much in active life. What does that mean? That Vorx has 8,000 more years of experience under his sagging belt? No, it does not. It means nothing. Dragan has met creatures birthed at the dawn of the Imperial Age whose voyages in the Eye have given them less subjective life experience than he has. It matters not where one comes from, nor on what world one's cells first fused together. It only matters what one does once the choked breaths start coming. In a similar vein, he has thought from time to time on the experience of the Primarchs. Those demented paragons lived a real life only for a couple of centuries before being hurled back into their elemental prisons. There they squatted amid failure and sucked their yellowing teeth. They consulted grimoire and they built altars. They had less exposure to the realm of the real than he has had. Thus, Dragan cultivates his contempt for the Primarchs. Not quite for his own, of course. In the Death Guard, rank and suzerainty still have weight. But even then, there is that old paradox. The Imperials only venerate their Primarchs because they are all dead. If any lived, they would soon remember what fools they were and despise them too. A long time ago, Slurt had taken Dragon down to the underpiles of the engine runoff chamber. Slurt had found something that piqued his obsessive interest, an insectoid hive, all wattles and hexagons running off into darkness, crammed with buzzing sting nightmares with jade eyes and dragging flails. The species, it seemed, was entirely novel, some kind of emergent fusion of blowfly and void wasp. The drones had dragged some of the population into their colony, injecting larvae under flabby skin as the wretches wriggled and twitched. Slurt had burned his way deep into the hive, ignoring the stings that pumped fresh and welcome poisons into him. In the pulsing heart of that place, he found the queen. The thing was impressively grotesque, swollen beyond reason, with a translucent sac that quivered as it squirted out glossy eggs. He had shown this to Dragon, as if some great lesson were revealed by it.
"What is this?" Dragon asked. "Of all the creatures," Slurt said, "this is the only one that never leaves the hive. They feed it. They feed it until its flesh stretches and it cannot get out."
The putrefier looked at Dragon in the dark, his rotted death mask partly hidden behind the swarms.
"So the queen is the slave."
It was an unsubtle point. Slurt had a tendency to hammer these things home. Back then, though, the observation had more currency. The Primarchs were still slumped on their self-made dream worlds, rolling around in acrimony and self-loathing, and unable to leave them. Only the Despoiler had had the belly fire to strike out beyond the gate's reach in numbers, demonstrating at a stroke the indulgence and passivity of the Elder Order. Ah, the Despoiler. There is a conundrum. Dragon goes faster now. He vaults stairs and climbs up through the flickering dark. Everything has changed. The old lords are stirring again, breaking out through the breach carved for them by Abaddon's ambition. Certainty, honed over millennia, has been fractured. It was never supposed to play out like this, and Dragon suspects that now they're out, the old Legion Masters will go ahead and foul things up again just as they did before. That makes him angry. It is the source of much of his current anger. He can no longer cleave to a path that had once seemed utterly secure. He will have to improvise, ride the changes, see just how much stupidity the Lords of Silence will put up with from Vorks before it comes down to blades. He reaches the antechamber just below the Sensorium Bridge. He can hear commotion, shouting from the unchanged, and even growls and barked orders from the unbroken. Heavy machinery is being dragged around by chain gangs, and it makes the sagging decks shed rust flakes. By the time he reaches the access hatch, it has become a cacophony, and the disorder irritates him. He meets Hovik just before the piston lift to the next level. The ship's master looks unsteady. She has a gash on her forehead, and her hair has come undone from its bun.
"What happened?" Dragon asks.
He towers over her. Hovik was once taller, but she is diminishing now, fattening, being crushed into a ball by her plagues. When she breathes, it is with a wheeze, and her cheeks are mottled red.
"I think,"
she begins, then reaches for a bulkhead for support.
"I think the warp drives."
Dragon hesitates.
"Ignited?"
"Not fully, and I do not know why yet."
She swallows, and a pop of yellow liquid marks the corner of her mouth.
"Maybe not the warp drives."
She is not focusing well. Dragon looks beyond her, up into the lift shaft from where more funks of bulky equipment are coming.
"A mess," he spits. "Where is the siege master?"
"I do not know."
"He's not on the bridge?"
"The bridge is a wreck, Lord."
And then he has a brief flicker of concern. Vorks might have died. He might have been crushed by something, destroyed by a hand other than Dragon's own. He moves towards the elevator entrance, going faster now, ignoring Hovik as she gradually squats down on the deck, retching. He reaches the access platform and sees the carnage for himself. There are unbroken corpses among the wreckage, lit by the sparking flash of electrics going off. Armaglass has shattered, flecking the decks with a glinting carpet of shards. Far above him are octagonal real viewer blisters, clustered like compound eye lenses. He can see the void through them, and for a moment thinks he catches the dark grey slab that was the Iron Shade's vessel. But even during the engagement, that ship never got properly close. They had pummeled one another from thousands of kilometres away, hurling plasma across a burning void. Only the boarding teams had given the fight anything like a proper character, and Dragan had at least tasted the blood of the enemy before the wrench into oblivion pulled everything apart. If Hovik was right, something had gone strangely awry. It took hours to prime the warp furnaces. The navigators needed to be hauled from their incubator cells and plugged into Solus's nexus. Then again, it was unclear whether navigators, even the vat-gorged horrors the Legion cultivated, were of much use now. The corpse spawn's beacon is stuttering, ran the rumours. Even so, warp drives do not just ignite. Dragan strides through the detritus. His boot crunches through a supine servitor, and it barely coughs as its femur snaps. He sees the empty throne ahead of him, rising out of a jumble of wreckage. There are surf crew milling around it, trying to clear the worst of the debris away, but the seat itself is empty. Dragan looks at it. He looks at the way the arms curve out, built for the dimensions of a human normal, but steadily augmented by Solus's slow mutations, so that an unbroken master can be accommodated in suitable majesty. He considers the gravid weight of the columns. He notes the faded verdigris on the old copper, and believes he can still make out the eroded impression of an aquila somewhere in all that bulbous metalwork. He sees the sign of the closed lips over the headrest, the sigil of the Lords of Silence, streaked with oil. The throne cannot remain empty. That is the first principle. He looks at it for a long time. Then he hears voices, commands, requests for commands, cries for help. Hovik has followed him in, and other senior crew are crawling back to their stations. A plasma chamber bursts into life, flaring lime green behind the crystal frontage. Vorx isn't here. Someone needs to take charge. Dragan strides down from the empty throne.
"Get us augurs," he barks at the sensorium pits. "We're blind, and I want eyes."
He keeps half a glance on the real viewers. The stars look strange.
"Where are we?" he thinks.
Chapter 3 Garstag is still fighting. He was among the first into action, stalking down the long accessways into the starboard decks above the main gunnery spine. He took the Cardane with him, six battle brothers in the same mix of Terminator-class plate. Some is Tartarus pattern, some cataphracti, some of more obscure provenance, or no longer clearly identifiable. They carry flails, mauls, and compy bolters, clattering heavily down the crowded passages with condensation steaming from their vox grills. It was a brave decision to board Solus. The enemy must have been expecting reinforcements at some stage, for even Imperial Space Marines would not be boneheaded enough to take on a fully loaded Grand Cruiser in scattered squads. The Lords of Silence are a powerful warband, numbering more than 600 unbroken and several thousand unchanged, ably prepared to defend a ship that is more than partly alive, and which harbours a vindictive streak towards its old makers. Solus was prepared not for mere raiding, but for invasion. It is equipped for decades of continuous warfare, a shipborne army in its own right. So they must have been expecting reinforcements. What happened to prevent it? What had that lurch been, and why were the lumens blown? Why is Solus so badly damaged? Garstag does not have time to reflect on that. He pushes himself back into a combat stance, shoving aside the shattered remnants of a bulkhead hatch. The Cardane are knee-deep in filth and broken metal, locked in darkness and only visible from muzzle flashes and the dark green glow of their helm lenses. This chamber is where the enemy has decided to make their stand. 20 of them, he thinks, tactical marines of the Iron Shades chapter, isolated and cut off and determined to die with honour. He does not cry out as he cuts into them. They are shouting liberally as they fight back, spewing invective and battle chants. This seems to animate them, to give their blows added heft. They are skilled and committed, moving fast even in the tight confines and plentiful wreckage. Garstag sees a space marine vault across a collapsed beam and empty his bolter into the oncoming charge of Brannad, one of the Cardane, which slows his advance significantly. But they are fighting a losing battle. The very environment is raised against them. Glowing tentacles burst from the foaming water, grasping at their legs and arms. There are little lords in the rafters, and they throw themselves at the warriors with snickering abandon, chewing down on power cables and armor joints. Every time a fighter has to shake one off, it gives time for Garstag's brothers to close in and finish the task. Terminator plate gives them a huge advantage, and this is no standard tactical dreadnought armor. Like everything else, it has been changed, expanded, thickened, and mutated. Brannad has a curl of sucker-encrusted hooks for a right arm, writhing like a nest of serpents. Artarian has a fanged mouth snapping over the barrel of his heavy bolter, which is linked to his body by permanent strands of glistening mucus. Garstag himself has the greatest of the gifts, a chainsword of living talons, crackling with corpuscent and dripping with ever-renewing toxins. Garstag does not attempt to emulate the swift strikes of the enemy. He trusts in his colossal ability to absorb punishment and strides through the murk in stately measure, taking hits from bolt rounds and barely flinching. The Cardane are fighting as the Death Guard have always fought, like a gauntlet closing on a throat, slowly building pressure, building and building until resistance snaps. The Iron Shade leaps out at him from the darkness, sable armor glinting, sweeping a power blade close, two-handed. He's far faster than Garstag, and the crackling edge sinks into his leading shoulder guard. Living ceramite closes over the wound instantly, sucking the sword from the Space Marine's grasp. He reaches for his bolt pistol, but Garstag can grab him now, seizing him by the throat with his claw. For a second, the Iron Shade fights back, thrashing out as his boots leave the deck. But then Garstag squeezes, a savage contraction of servos and fused sinew, and his attacker's neck is broken. Garstag throws the limp body aside, and it crashes into the blood-foamed filth. Then there is another coming at him. Perhaps he is some champion, his path cleared by the sacrifice of a lesser warrior. He carries his own chainsword in one hand and a bolter in the other. The combined assault is formidable, a punch-rain of shells backed up by heavy swipes of gunning-linked teeth. Garstag is rocked by it, smashed back on his heels, and forced to parry with his blade. He sees the death mask of his enemy loom out of the murk, a pair of backlit lenses like a ghost's eyes, and realizes he has miscalculated his momentum. But the enemy is suddenly thrown to one side, hit by a perfectly judged shot from an injector pistol. The dart slices out from the shadows and catches him at the neck, right in that minuscule sliver of weakness between helm and gorget. The champion reacts instantly, grabbing the barb and throwing it to one side. Garstag could strike him then, but chooses not to. There is no longer any point. Instead, he watches as the Iron Shade is rapidly consumed from within. A spasm, a shake, then blood fountaining from every armor joint. The Space Marine falls to his knees, vomiting through his helm's grill. Garstag can hear the fizz of flesh being eaten, even under his armor. The rest of the corpse spawn are beaten back now. They are falling away, harried on every side, pursued down the corridor by the Cardane, dogged by swarms of little lords, struck by falling spars and foaming gouts of corrosive liquid. Garstag sees others of the population joining the hunt now, which for them is really a race for scraps of carrion. Breaking out through rust-weakened holes and rents, their faces locked into desperate grins, and their eyes staring. And Slurt is there too. Strange Slurt. Odd Slurt, who is hateful but useful, and who seems to spirit into existence at the most opportune moments. The putrefier is holstering his injector pistol and looking at the twitching results of his work. His bottle-lensed helm is impassive, but his awkward body mimics the death spasms of his victim. Garstag growls at him, feeling phlegm build up in his throat, and flexes his claw. He would like to plunge his talons through Slurt and see how long it takes for the war of poisons to play out. But he holds back, of course, for he knows that the combat anger is on him, and that it will subside, and that Slurt is one of Vaux's protected, and that all these things are important.
"Clumsy, Cardane Master,"
Slurt says, amused, still looking at the corpse in the murk.
"He would have cut your throat out."
"Why are you here?" Garstag asks.
"I've been roaming."
As Slurt speaks, a little lord plops down from the roof space and splats onto his shoulder. It coos affectionately into Slurt's clogged earpiece, and Slurt lets it nuzzle.
"This is all very unusual, don't you think?"
Garstag looms closer, his hooves splashing in the bloody, oily mire.
"Get away from me! Stay away from me! I have the just desire to slaughter, and you are now very close."
Slurt shrinks back. The little lord spits at Garstag, then darts under the cover of Slurt's cloak.
"Not nice," says Slurt. "Things are running ragged on this ship. Where are we? You know that? No, you know nothing."
Garstag doesn't care. He was promised a proper war, one that had been in preparation for mortal generations. These dregs are not what he came for, but for the time being, they are all he has. He can still hear fighting echoing down the accessways, muffled and dampening. He moves off, but Slurt dares to reach out, to pull him back.
"Someone activated the warp drives," Slurt says. "Dangerous, dangerous. We might all be atoms now. Know anything about that, Cardane Master?"
Garstag turns on him, towering over him, his heavy helm plate pushed into Slurt's face.
"Nothing. I do not care for the ship, and I do not care for you. We have a realm before us, its back broken and ready to scour. That is all I care about. All. If you want to play games, go and find another degenerate."
Slurt laughs.
"So many to choose from."
But Garstag has swept off, not listening. There are faint signals on his helm display, blotches of yellow in the gloom. There might be boarding parties still alive somewhere, and they all need hunting down.
"So you won't say where you were?"
Slurt calls after him. Garstag keeps moving. Vaux is returning. He has left it too long already, but there were thoughts to be thought and numbers to be considered. He has not killed, and that will be noted. He guesses Dragon will have finished many of the invaders. Garstag will have accounted for many more. Before the wrench, Vaux had even considered sending a party to seek out Naum, though he is glad now that he didn't. Naum would not have understood the situation at all. Naum is a tortured soul for all the gifts he has been given, and that is a great pity. Vaux no longer sees information flowing across the interior of his helm, as he did in the distant past, because his visor substrate is now a part of his face. So his visual field is a complex thing, a psychological layering of true vision, machine overlay, and dream projections spiked with electrical impulses from what was once a tactical broadcast implant. He cannot close his eyes, which are lubricated by a steady trickle of moisture from capillary glands. When he sleeps, it is merely a haze of torpor marching with vivid, eyes-open dreams.
"These are the ways we exemplify the lessons," he thinks. "These are the ways we shape the old faith."
He climbs back up from Philemon's cubbyhole, breathing heavily. His gauntlets grasp flaking iron and scrape across blistered synth leather. To reach the bridge again, he has chosen to pass through the sanctuary. He does not know what place this was when Solus was an imperial vessel, possibly an audience hall for visiting dignitaries, or maybe some equipment chamber hollowed out of its machinery. Now it echoes with enormity, broken up by slender columns that strike up through a jungle of vegetation. The sanctuary must be 200 meters long, a snaking gallery that threads through the belly of the ship like a bloated liver, sucking up the poisons and the swills and slowly fermenting them. Vats bubble with simmering things only to spill over into thick mulch below as their feet corrode away. Ferns and kelp tubes thread upwards into the high gallery, each as black as nightshade and pocked with glowing phosphor spines. Creatures whimper in the fetid shadows, all vectors of powerful plagues, their jaws pink with scurvy and their eyes half closed from the close press of sores. Vaux likes the sanctuary. It is a miniature representation of the many gardens of the plague planet, which are in themselves mere reflections of the one true garden. It is the closest his people will ever come to having shrines. The Lords of Silence come to these groves when they are able to breathe in the air, to feel the churn of the rotting soils beneath them. The sanctuary is disturbed then, just as all things on the ship are. Its branches sway as if a wind blows through them, and spiky leaf clusters shed in thumps. The creatures nuzzle and burrow to avoid him, so Vaux travels through the groves unimpeded, and the strands and fronds drag across his armour. He only pauses once, in one of the many dark glades, to see a fresh species of orchid pushing its head through the leaf matter. He stoops to regard it. Its stem is a virulent green, its bulbous head strikingly purple. It has sacs under its petals that shiver when he breathes on them. He reaches out with a finger to touch it and feels tiny pricks from hidden stingers folded within its delicate frame. They give him an unusual wave of pain that endures for several seconds before his physiology is able to transmute it. Vaux smiles. He will have to return to this glade soon. He may ask Philemon to categorize the orchid, to take cuttings. Slurt may even wish to use it for refining purposes. The sanctuary is bountiful. Like all such gardens, it creates more than it destroys. Nothing remains the same for long. There is always the slow creep of change. That is the thing that sets his kind apart from the old Imperium. The corpse spawn desire, above all things, stasis. They preserve, they record, they clamp down hard on the passage of time. They are caught in their single moment, one that should have been confined to history 10 millennia ago, a moment that freezes their muscles and keeps their mouths and minds shut. It will be a mercy to end that empire, for there is no greater agony than rictus. Vaux keeps walking. Foliage tugs at him as he passes, wrapping tiny strands around his boots and kneecaps. Everything in this place would kill him, if it could. It would strangle him, render him down, suck out his vital juices, and refine them into something more diffuse. He does not mind that. It strikes him as an apt metaphor for his position at the head of this warband. He is perfectly aware that maintaining command is a matter of survival. If he delivers victories, he will be suffered to lead. If he fails, sooner or later someone will challenge him. Deposed leaders are not permitted to remain at liberty. Death is one of the better outcomes for them. He is philosophical about that. The galaxy has become an angrier place during the course of the Long War, but he does not share in its many pathologies. He can remember fighting in the Legion soon after it had ceased to be the Dusk Raiders and become the Death Guard, when his armour was bone pale and bore the marks of filth as a badge of pride. Before that, he can remember fighting and living on Barbarus as a child, and that was a true nightmare. Nothing could be as bad as that again. A scrabble for survival within a planet-wide prison that crushed the soul and shredded the nerves. Mortarion freed them from that. This is what Dragon and the other latecomers will never properly understand. Vaux is not a blind fanatic and understands that the Primarch has weaknesses, but he will never forget that first act of liberty. Unless you had tried to scratch a gasping living on the stinking white soils of that hell world, unless you had actually witnessed what the mountain lords could do with impunity to the cowering mortals, and unless you had seen what the Death Lord had done to free them, you could not truly comprehend. That was why the Death Guard had never fractured,